This is our number two.
It's time for the fastest 15 minutes in the news. This is Dory's Fastest 15.
Welcome to the Fastest 15, a world of news in 15 tidy minutes. I think that's the way that Dory says it, right, Nicole? I nailed it. Did I pull it off?
Yeah, that's close. We'll take it.
So, So when I woke up this morning, I read a headline that said that Elon Musk had put his purchase of Twitter on hold pending a report on the proliferation of spam bots. And this piqued my interest because I wrote about this extensively in college. And then this is Justin. He says that he's still committed. He just wanted to see to what extent the numbers of users on Twitter are actually real versus bots. It looks like it's in the neighborhood of about 5 to 7% of the users on Twitter are bots. That's pretty standard on any social media platform. It goes the same for YouTube. YouTube has about the same numbers. Facebook has the same numbers. And you might be asking yourself, like, why would somebody need a bot? Why would somebody need a fake user account? It can be anything for, like, a Smurf account as an example. So somebody uses that account. Let's say there's somebody at the New York Times, and they want to boost up the amount of views that are on a particular article that they've posted on Twitter. So they have a bunch of Smurf accounts that are programmed to retweet or like or heart or whatever that is, so that within the Twitter algorithm, that story gets boosted. It happens all the time on places like YouTube, where people will have fake accounts that are specifically programmed to like or to subscribe to a certain number of other channels. It's all to try to fool or trick the algorithm into boosting certain content over other content. And I understand why Elon Musk would be hesitant about it or even want to know to what extent this is, because it's kind of a cancer on a platform. A better way to put it, I guess, is it disrupts the way that the algorithm is supposed to function naturally. So an algorithm for something like Twitter or for Facebook or for YouTube or for Instagram is a filtering mechanism. Nicole, have you ever heard about this, the way that the algorithms work?
Well, I don't really understand everything about the algorithms,
right.
But yes, I mean, I do know about them.
Yeah, the idea behind it is that you have a piece of content and you want to see if that piece of content will draw more viewers in to view that piece, like if it's a cat video, right, or if it's John Curley golfing or whatever it is. So what the algorithm will do is that once that video or once that thing is posted, in the first seconds that it is posted, it wants to see how many people interact with it, how long they interact with it. And if it fails a certain threshold, it gets either promoted within the algorithm or demoted within the algorithm. Mm-hmm. And that's basically how they're sorted over time. So you can manipulate it by automatically pushing down certain key buzzwords. And this is something that Twitter was notorious for doing, and to their detriment, particularly when it came to the Hunter Biden laptop story. You have to think about it in many ways as burying the content. They're not so much hiding it from people outright as much as they are just burying it with all this other kind of useless information that they put on top of it so that people don't necessarily have access to it. So with all that in mind, I totally understand why Elon Musk would be a little bit hesitant about it. Some people were saying that this is an attempt at him to back out of it. I don't think he wants to back out of it at this point in time.
It's $1 billion if he backs out. So that was an expensive publicity stunt, if that's
very, very. I think that he is maybe trying to put more focus on the fact that he wants to buy it. And I think, and this is just me, I don't have any evidence for this, but I think that if Elon Musk owns Twitter, it will become a profitable company. I think that he recognizes the potential that it has as an avenue to disseminate information. One of the things I think that has prevented Twitter from really becoming a profitable company is that it is an exclusionary platform. And everybody knows this. It's no secret. They are heavily biased towards one particular political slant. Even Jack Dorsey, the former CEO, admitted this, and he said that he thought it was a problem. As a matter of fact, Jack Dorsey came out last week, and he himself said that he did not think that Donald Trump should have been permabanned from Twitter. So my sneaking suspicion is that in the long run, Elon Musk is going to be able to take the Twitter platform, and he's going to be able to make it a profitable company by making it accessible to multiple points of view. And the other thing about this, Nicole, it's fascinating. I don't think a lot of people realize this, is that around 2015, 2016, Twitter changed the way that their algorithm worked, and they started doing this thing called siloing, where they wanted people to interact with the platform longer. But what they thought was that if people saw things that made them upset, let us just say someone sees a picture of Donald Trump, that they would close the app and they would go, I don't want to use this anymore because I don't like Donald Trump. So they started siloing people, which is basically we see how long someone looks at an image of, let us just say, Joe Biden or a story from the Huffington Post or a story from BuzzFeed. And if they stay for a certain threshold, we're going to keep pushing that material. And then also having them interact with other users or suggesting other Twitter feeds that are also within that same bracket. And this is where we get what we call an echo chamber within Twitter. It's crazy what they decided to do with that platform back 2015, 2016, and completely changed the way that it was designed to function, which was to have voices from multiple people all interacting with each other at the same time. I've actually seen data sets, Nicole, get this, where you can see the division between users and their political preferences on a graph. It's like two huge clouds, one of them blue, one of them red, and they don't interact with each other whatsoever. And that was a decision that I don't know if Dorsey made that decision or if some IT person, the chief technical engineer or whatever, made that decision. But that's what ultimately led to Twitter's downfall. And if Musk gets in there, I imagine that he's going to remove that process. So people will be forced or not necessarily forced, but they will have access to information which they may not like, or they'll have to be exposed to media that they don't necessarily want to see, whether it's from Fox News or from CNN or whatever it is. And then that will be a fun little experiment to see if people still want to use the app when they have access to all the information that they're trying to get. You see what I'm saying, Nicole? It's like, if by making it, dare I say, more equitable, you right. then make the you make it more profitable.
And I've talked about this before, but the most exciting thing to me is to either make verification somewhat mandatory, so your Joe Schmo can get verified because he proves who he is and can interact. I kind of hate the way that the blue check makes you more important on Twitter, and I wish he would take some of that away. I mean, in general, I think Twitter is toxic right now, and I don't like it, and everybody knows it. But I am hopeful. It's also very useful to me, and I have to use it for my job, and you know, I don't have to interact on it, but I am on it all the time. And I am hopeful that Elon does things to make it less toxic, because I really hate the verification thing. Even if it, yeah. I mean, even if I were verified and if I got that check mark, I would still hate it, because how does that make me more important? and now my opinion matters more because I have a check. Like, it doesn't make sense unless it's for everyone. So you know that this person is a person. It's not some guy in his basement pretending to be somebody else, or, you know, one of his 15 profiles or whatever it is.
Right. Well, and that's the other issue, is that you have people who have multiple user accounts, and they can just go in and they can be trolls, and they can say awful, disgusting and terrible things about people, and there is no accountability. But I do have all the confidence in the world that Elon Musk is going to be able to make that a profitable company when he takes it private.
I kind of would love the idea of having everyone have to put who their employer is. So if you're going to be a troll, if you're going to say something that's ridiculous, know that we all know where you work. And it doesn't.
I'm
not trying to cancel anybody. I just want people to own their comments more, because if it's fine, if what you're saying is negative and fine, and your employer doesn't care, or you don't care that you're attached to that employer, whatever it is, fine. But know that people have more information about you, just like a celebrity. I mean, they get canceled all the time too from Twitter posts. And it's because we know where they work, right? And I just, yeah. I want to take some of the anonymity out of it so that people have to own what they say and not just put garbage out there. You're right to do so, but own it if you're going to do it.
Yeah, I agree. I think that that would improve Twitter dramatically if people had to actually own the things that they put on that platform and they weren't able to hide behind, you know, at some nickname that they've given themselves, but they actually had to be the person that they say that they are. I think that would be fantastic. And next up in the Fastest 15, this story really brightened my day when I read this morning. Norm MacDonald shot a secret final Netflix stand-up before passing away. That celebrity death, Nicole, hit me differently because I grew up with Norm MacDonald going on Conan O'Brien. I used to stay up late. I was kind of a bad kid. I would stay up late because I loved to watch Conan O'Brien. And Norm MacDonald was a frequent contributor to Conan O'Brien when he had the Late Late Show. And I just remember like thinking, this is the funniest guy on the planet. Like, there is nobody funnier than this guy. The way that he was able to navigate jokes and humor, he had a huge influence on a young teenage Jack Stein sneaking into the guest room so that he could watch Conan O'Brien at 12:30 at night. And when I found out that he passed away, it was almost like, for me, it was like when I found out that Steve Irwin died. Do you know what I mean? It was like, yeah, because Steve Irwin was kind of the same way for me when I was a kid. It was like Steve Irwin was the coolest guy on the planet. And then when he died, I was legitimately kind of wrecked around it. Mm-hmm. So when I found out that Norm MacDonald shot this secret stand-up special, I thought, this is amazing. And then you had the best line about it, which was that it's a very Norm MacDonald thing to do, right?
Right. I know, I loved him. This is when I watched him when he was on Saturday Night Live, and my friends and I would all get together on Saturday nights and actually watch it live. That was the height of what I consider Saturday Night Live. Obviously, I wasn't around for the 70s, so some people might say that. But for me, that was the height of Saturday Night Live before it became what it is now, whatever that is. I always loved him. And then, you know, the Billy Madison grown-ups, like his association with Adam Sandler. And then I actually watched The Middle. I loved The Middle. And when he was on that was fun. And I think it's awesome he did this. And I know Dory's going to be so stoked for this.
Yeah. I got to say this about Saturday Night Live. I've had this thought in the back of my head for a while now. I don't know the last time I actually saw a funny piece of material from Saturday Night Live. And I am a connoisseur of comedy and writing and sketch writing. I don't know the last time I saw something that was legitimately laugh out loud funny.
For sure. Back in the 90s, maybe Will Ferrell, 90s, Norm MacDonald days. That's it.
Yeah. Maybe. And even, you know, Tina Fey was a really brilliant writer back in the day, back before she totally lost her mind. Seth Meyers had some really great bits that he wrote personally, again, before he lost his mind. It seems like I'll tell you what ruined Saturday Night Live, unfortunately. The Donald Trump presidency is the one thing, like they had Saturday Night Live and they were really trying to be funny and political and topical. And then when Donald Trump became president, it's like they hated the man so much that the show just became an hour and a half of how many jokes can we make about Donald Trump?
It just became more mean-spirited. Before it
mean,
was just funny, and it just became so mean-spirited. I just don't know what they were trying to accomplish with that.
Yeah, and I get that there's a lot of things to make fun of about former President Donald Trump, but for like 4 years, after a while, it's like, you know, there's a lot of other stuff. There's lots of other politicians out there to like crack wise at. You know, Nancy Pelosi, a pretty weird lady. You get a lot of jokes out of that. Get a lot of mileage out of Mitch McConnell. You get a lot of mileage out of Chuck Schumer. Get a lot of mileage out of AOC. But they refused to do it. And it just became this like this bizarre kind of anti-Trump hour and a half. And I just had to just stop because it was almost embarrassing to watch. Like, let's get Alec Baldwin again for the 18th week in a row. And he'll play Donald Trump and he'll be stupid and silly. And it just didn't make any sense whatsoever. Oh, and then finally, by the way, before we get out of here, I just wanted to point this out. In the UK, apparently now calling men bald is sexual harassment in the workplace, which makes me feel bad, Nicole, because as you know, I'm slowly losing my hair over time.
Well, so I now mean, I can't sometimes go to the UK. It's sexy.
I don't know. All right. Listen, I got to get out of here. We'll take a really quick break. And when we get back, we got a whole lot more of the Dori Monson Show coming up for you. After this, we're going to be getting into Jen Psaki and the new Ultra MAGA crowd coming up right after this. Welcome back to the Dori Monson Show. I have been really interested in Joe Biden's attempt to kind of navigate talking about Trump while also trying to downplay the fact that there are moms out there that don't have formula for their babies. Because you'll notice this, Nicole, every time something happens that is Joe Biden's responsibility or it's within his purview as the president of the United States, all of a sudden he starts talking about Donald Trump like crazy. Have you noticed that?
Oh, yeah. That's the go-to. Everything bad. He has to, if anything is negative, he has to remind people that it's all, in his eyes, Donald's fault.
Right. Which is fascinating. But like Donald Trump hasn't been the president of the United States for about a year and a half at this point in time. And so the whole this technique that Biden keeps using, it is an antiquated political technique, and it doesn't work on people anymore because we live in the information age. We live in the technology age where we can literally access anything at any time. So when people read stuff like, oh, well, there's actually baby formula in the United States, it's just going to, you know, the southern border so moms at the border can feed their babies. That kind of stuff gets to people. I think it irritates people when Biden can't even address what is actually going on. And then they read about, oh, well, we do have this surplus of baby formula. It's just going to the southern border for people who are attempting to enter the United States. So in any case, recently, Psaki was asked about Biden's decision to call Trump the MAGA king and his followers ultra MAGA. Nicole, I think we got that cut.
He went off about MAGA again.
Yeah. MAGA king.
Yes,
king
he
MAGA.
To former President Trump as the ultra MAGA king. He's been decrying ultra MAGA Republicans and saying he's going to be doing it more. Mm-hmm. But Hillary Clinton expressed some regret not too long ago for referring to Trump voters as deplorables who couldn't be redeemed. And considering that Trump got 74 million votes in the last election, I'm just wondering if this is the best strategy for Biden to win people over, win over support ahead of the midterms, especially given his inaugural theme being America United.
Well, I would say that the president is not afraid to call out what he sees as extreme positions that are out of line with where the American people stand.
I know that's Jen Psaki's job to do this, but when you say something that is obviously that false, I find it to be deeply, deeply, deeply irritating. Like Biden has come out several times and he has said that the most extreme group in the United States is the quote unquote MAGA crowd or the ultra MAGA crowd. Which you could make the case for that. It wouldn't be a very good one, but you could certainly make that case. And then when he is asked about Antifa, which he was asked about several times during the campaign, he says Antifa is an idea. It's not actually real people. It's just a philosophy. Well, Nicole, I told you this previously, but I actually spent some time with some members of Antifa or some purported members of Antifa a couple weeks back.
On the phone? I hope you weren't actually – were you having coffee with them?
I was invited to like a dinner drinks kind of a thing with a friend of ours who works
happy
at a restaurant.
Happy hour with Antifa?
I had happy hour with Antifa. And so I know I admittedly they could have just been playing pretend, but they came across as being legitimate because the conversation came up. They said, "Where do you do? Where do you work? What do you do?" I said, "I do radio for Cairo Radio." And they went, "Ah, yes." And they were talking about the Pacific Northwest, and they were talking about Oregon, and they were talking about all their various activities. And then I think that they felt as if they could kind of flex in front of me. It was a couple. It was a man and a woman. And I think that they felt like maybe I would be in shock and awe when they admitted to me that they were members of Antifa or they had participated in anti-fascist action or movement, which is the way that they phrased it. And I strike up conversation with him, and you know when you get like really focused in, you know, there's a lot of people around us at this particular dinner, but you know when you get really drawn into a conversation with people and everyone else just kind of fades out of the room?
Uh-huh.
That's what happened to us. So we end up having this really nice like 30-minute conversation where I'm like literally talking to terrorists, which was fascinating.
And so they admitted to causing violence and destruction.
No, they do this really interesting thing where, for instance, they were talking about like Chaz Chop, and they do this thing where they go, "But we would never do that," and then they wink. It's this really kind of sardonic, sarcastic thing where they were talking about the riots.
They would wink at each other or at you?
They would wink at me, huh. Like it was cutesy. It was really interesting.
Oh,
so I asked them, and I said, how do you coordinate that kind of action? And they told me all about how they have these encrypted apps that they install on their phone, and they are given like geolocational data as to where they should meet and where they should congregate. And then they all show up totally encrypted, by the way, all of the information going through this. And then when they meet, they are given basically paramilitary orders. So it's not like it's just this random mob. So it's one group is going to go over here and they're going to start a fire, or they're going to start yelling at these protesters. And then another group is going to circle around over here and they're going to start a different, or they're going to be filming it or whatever it is. It's highly, highly, highly coordinated protest and I might say terrorism. And I find it really interesting that Joe Biden, the president of the United States, has never not once said, we have a problem with extremism in this country and it happens to exist with both the far right and the far left. Instead, he chooses to hammer down on the quote-unquote ultra MAGA crowd, which if I had to guess out of Trump's 30 million base, if I had to guess ultra MAGA is probably less than about 1,000 people, maybe 2,000 people tops. And I'm talking about people who would be willing to commit acts of violence for Donald Trump. What's my evidence for this? January 6th. I mean, the people that actually made it into the Capitol or actually were at the Capitol building. It's around 2,000 people, maybe 2,500 people tops.
Right. And I think that number would be dwindled now because I think that people didn't know what they were getting into that day. Some did. But some people did not know what they were getting into that day.
Yeah, and the thing that I found interesting in talking to this couple is that they were very open with the fact that they were part of an organization, that it's not some idea, that it's not some philosophy. It's something that they consider to be direct political action or direct political speech. And that's the philosophy that they use, that if a democracy is going to fail them, and this is the language that they use, that if democracy is going to fail them, then they're going to take democracy into their own hands until it works for them. I found that to be absolutely fascinating. And so where is Joe Biden? I'm just curious. Where is Joe Biden saying, we also have a problem with these far left activists who are willing to commit acts of violence against other human beings? It would be fair of him to say that.
It would. I'm just curious. What did these people do for a living? How do they make money?
They were baristas.
Of course they were. They're trying to unionize, right?
They were baristas. And I don't want to mention the chain, but let's just say it's a very popular chain. And they were staunch socialists, and they very much so believed in the upcoming socialist utopia. And I will say this, though, very friendly, very funny, but also like crazy sociopaths. It was a really interesting, I want to say, 30, 45 minutes of my life to actually talk to people who were willing to be that open about it and be so casual about it.
They were a married couple that believed that barista job was their career and they should be paid as much as anyone else who's gone to school and worked to get where they are 20 years and whatever. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, but because their labor is a piece of them. You see what they're saying, that their labor is so when they make that cup of coffee, that is a physical, they're giving a piece of their soul to the consumer, and thus it should be compensated well for that.
Okay.
So And I also got to say this. The gypsy must have cursed me when I was like 4 or 5 years old, because I always end up having conversations with people that just out of nowhere. And I don't know what it is. I just, maybe I'm just a friendly guy and I'm willing to talk to anybody. But I guess that's just the way that it is. All right. We'll take a really quick break when we get back. Amazon is currently in trouble for sharing our information. And you know what? I'm totally okay with it. We'll take a really quick break. We'll be right back with the Dory Monson Show right after this. Welcome back to the Dory Monson Show, rolling through several hours, probably the highest rated, yeah? You guys, the numbers for Dory Monson Show is absolutely amazing. Now, I have good numbers, but they're not as good as Dory Monson's, right?
Well, yeah, I mean, it's just your time slot, you know? You gotta bump yourself up in the day when people are out and about, moving around.
Yeah. I know. So, but that's the thing I like about Dory is that both Dory and I take time to mention to everybody that we have very good ratings. So, Nicole, I have this weird thing that's going on with my Amazon account where I buy stuff for Sarah using my Amazon account on my phone, or I'll give Sarah my phone and she'll type in what she wants to buy and then she'll buy it using my card. It's like, you know, sunscreen, lipstick. When we were in Maui, she had to order some stuff.
That's cool. She just has to add it to the cart. You grab it.
Yeah. I mean, like, if she doesn't have, it's the way our kind of relationship works. Like, sometimes I'll grab, like, I get all of my nicotine lozenges through Sarah's Amazon account. I don't pay for them.
Maybe track to
so,
you.
Yeah. So, but now I'm getting targeted ads for women's clothing and lipstick and like nighties and things of that nature. I'm getting them sent to my inbox. I'm getting them sent to my Gmail. I'm getting them push notifications. Jack Stein, Lulu LaRoe is having a sale on blah, 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 blah. And I'm thinking to myself, this is the dark side of Amazon, because now Amazon, I used to get notifications for like vitamins or sports gear or whatever it is. And now I'm getting notifications for stuff for ladies. And I feel weird about it, because if you looked at my notifications, you might think that Jack Stein is doing something secret behind closed doors. Do you know what I mean?
Okay.
I'm doing something weird behind closed doors.
Whenever you look for something, how it shows up forever. Forever it's in the ads. And it's not even something you want. You were just trying to see something. I don't know.
Right. Like, for instance, Sarah uses a very particular kind of sunscreen, right? So now I'm getting push ads for stuff that I would never use. Like
sunscreen?
Conditioner.
I hope you use
sunscreen.
Not sunscreen,
but I do use sunscreen. But it's like foundation, like UV protective foundation and all this stuff that I'm like, I don't need this. I need running shoes and yoga mats and vitamins. That's what I need. So Amazon's in a lot of trouble right now because there is an astronomical misuse of customer data that could ruin the country. That's according to a share, or not ruin the country, ruin the company. That's according to a shareholder. The basic idea is that Amazon has been scooping up your biometric data. So that's your fingerprints, facial images, also collecting your location within your home, your GPS location within your home, so that they can map your home. Also collecting individuals' images without their consent, as well as violating state laws that prohibit companies from profiting off of individuals' biometric data. So the Amazon app has this really interesting feature where you can point the camera into your living room and you can see what a couch would look like if you were to buy it off of Amazon. You can actually see it on your phone, what that would look like. What they don't tell you is that when you use that feature, Amazon keeps all of that data. Or when you, they also have another feature. Nicole, I don't know if you know about this, but you can stand in front of a mirror and pick the outfit that you want, and it will display on your phone you wearing that outfit. Isn't that crazy?
Wow, that is crazy. It's very Cher from Clueless.
Yeah. Yeah. And I actually got matched with that yellow dress that she wears, the skirt combo with the blazer.
Plaid.
The plaid. I got matched that, and I thought, oh, I look pretty good in this.
We're such 80s babies.
But they collect that data as well. So this is illegal in many, many states, including the state of California. You just absolutely cannot do this. And so there's a group of defendants that have been listed in this lawsuit. It's founder Jeff Bezos, CEO Jassy, Chief Financial Officer Brian Olsavsky, and it is also 11 members of the board. I don't think that this is really going to go anywhere. I think that people are basically fine with their data being taken from them for the most part. I don't think that people – I mean, they might end up paying a fine. They might end up paying something out to a couple different states. But I don't think that most Americans care because we're basically addicted to Amazon. I love Amazon. I can get all kinds of crazy stuff. So if they're taking my biometric data – I don't really want to use it. I know this sounds bad, but I'm now dependent on it for so many things in my life, like my nicotine lozenges or dog food, that I'm like,
you gotta get off
I
those.
Just want the nicotine lozenges, but I love food. Them. I have them, the dog food. Yeah, I just have a severe addiction to dog food right now. It's so bad. I just don't use the camera feature. And that seems to be the primary one, Nicole, that it's the camera feature that is soaking up all of this data. But you can also go into the app and make sure that you can actually turn off, you know, no location data, nothing, unless I actually open the app itself, which right. I highly recommend that people do.
Probably should bother us more that they do yeah. things, because obviously those are our laws put into place to protect us from something. And we should probably be more upset with them violating that. But we are addicted and too trusting, and it's probably going to bite us all in the butt eventually, but yeah, for now, but like, I can't let go of Amazon.
My thought is, like, if I need this, okay, so I've been doing a lot of vitamins recently. I've been doing a John Curley, so I've been just going out and getting tons and tons and tons of vitamins. This is the problem, is that if I go down to the vitamin shop, all of the vitamins that I need are 30 to 40% more than what they are on Amazon. And not
I
only know, that,
and
but,
I understand
right?
it, and I want to help the brick and mortar, but the difference is so huge. And right now we're dealing with high prices everywhere. It's hard to pay more to support these businesses that I really want to support, but it's just really yeah. hard when the price is so different.
Yeah, it truly is. And I guess we'll all have to stay abreast of this particular lawsuit as it rolls forward. All right, coming up next on the Dory Monson Show, Mr. John Curley is going to be dropping by, and we're going to be talking about the pro-abortion rights demonstrations expected to have thousands of people turn out tomorrow afternoon. We'll take a really quick break on the Dory Monson Show. We'll be right back right after this.